Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Come and show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 1968's Wonderwall, a trippy blend of surreal visuals and slapstick in which a scatterbrained professor becomes increasingly obsessed with his beautiful model neighbour called Penny Lane. Spying on her through self-made holes in the wall that separates them, the professor dreams psychedelic fantasy sequences that, crucially, are set to music specifically written for the film by one George Harrison. This officially marks it as the first ever solo album released by a Beatle, and also the first release for the Beatles' newly formed company Apple Records. But Ed, my first question is, taking all of this information into account, is today going to be the day that they throw it all back to you? Come on, I had to do it.
Are we really? All right, no, fair enough.
Let's just get all of that out of the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Here's a real question for you.
Sure.
What do we think of George's music contribution to this film? And I guess I was quite interested to understand what you think about what it suggests about his maturity as a songwriter at this stage.
Well, I think taking on a film score is pretty mature in general for any sort of pop songwriter. So George, by this point, is obviously coming into his own as a songwriter. So he's had sort of significant contributions, particularly on Revolver and the White Album, which I suppose they are recording around the same time. Yeah, I think like what you get here is his interest in Indian music is obviously completely to the fore, and I think it's probably kicking off that whole thing where the general association of sitars with psychedelia, you know, the whole thing where in a documentary like the Sgt. Pepper one that we did. Where they don't have the rights to use the music,
yes.
or indeed anything about the 1960s, is, you know, you'll get the sort of civil unrest in the streets montage, you know, with sort of Vietnam and all that kind of stuff, and then you'll get the montage of just like hippies sitting in fields with sort of painted faces, and that will generally be set to sitars.
So this is kind of the culmination of that for George, right? Even though he's introduced it earlier on in his career,
yeah.
But this is kind of those two things coming together, I guess, into one medium for him at this point in his career.
Yeah.
What's quite interesting to me about thinking about him as a mature songwriter taking on a film score is that the Let It Be sessions, I still think of him there as being quite an unconfident writer. Like, he still seems to want to check things with the rest of the band, and he still seems to want to sort of, you know, he wants their input. He seems a little bit less sure of his footing, I guess, with some of the songs he's written there. So it's interesting that this, and also this is one of those things where, this is one of those things that happens in the Beatles timeline where I just can't, like, compute in my head how this happens, like, alongside other stuff that I know is happening at the time in their,
right,
you know, in their timeline.
Right, so sort of in the same year, so the year kind of starts off with them going to Rishikesh, then they come back, as John said, rested and ready to play businessman, set up Apple, record the White Album. Does John get married in 1968? I think he probably does, or 69, I forget. But anyway, he and Yoko sort of properly become a thing in 1968. And they record Two Virgins. Anything else? Hey Jude.
just Hey Jude.
Just that. Yeah. So, you know, it's a bit, like, you look at any of the Beatles' years and you think it is absurd how much you have packed in.
Yeah, because I can't imagine how much time would have gone into writing and recording and the, you know, whatever work needs to go into the release of music like this.
Mm.
And I just, that it's one of those things that always gets bypassed when you have documentaries about the Beatles of this period.
Well, but I think, so probably the actual writing of this, I think, I'm not trying to be unkind about the music itself, but I think a lot of it is, he's sort of noodled around on something, right?
And he's got some,
so I think he went out to the EMI studio in Delhi and he got some local musicians to play on the thing. But, I think the actual writing of it is probably not a huge undertaking. As, you know, I mean, one of the other things that has an arguable claim to be first Beatles solo album is the score for The Family Way, which McCartney did in 1966. That is, because it's not, Paul is not credited as the artist, he composed it. But in the same way, I don't think, from what I understand, I think Paul kind of wrote a bit of a refrain, which he kind of gave to George Martin, who then just kind of, you know, scored bits around it and put the refrain in, you know, so.
Yeah, I think we're probably in danger a little bit of underserving George's role in the music for Wonderwall, though, in a sense.
Oh, sure,
that,
sure, sorry.
Sorry, I don't have to apologise to me.
Apologise to George. George Harrison.
but I know what you mean. I think the music does sound very noodly, but there's a clear effort involved in the production of this, and I think that one of the things that I was quite interested to think about when I was watching this and listening to the music was, are these songs that have been inspired by the film, or is this George Harrison noodling because he knows he can, he's got free reign to do whatever he likes, and this is just kind of something that is interesting and fun for him to do right now, like, how much of an artistic endeavour is this as a project that he has undertaken, versus how much is it as I've been given free reign to do whatever I want for this sort of weird funny film, and that means that I can explore whatever I like musically.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, like, you know, Indian music at the moment is sort of where his passion lies. I mean, by the way, this is broadly, I'm sure this isn't completely the case, but more or less the last time he ever uses a sitar on a record.
Oh God, is that right?
Well, I mean, because so there's no more sitar, I think I'm right in saying, in any Beatles recordings after Within You, Without You, 1967.
Right.
George, in general, because he said around this time that he sort of put down the sitar.
Yeah.
Like, and sort of went back to playing guitar. And I think that's when he kind of developed that signature slide guitar sound that we sort of know him for.
Yeah.
There are bits of sitar in Brainwashed, his posthumous album. But yeah, and, you know, I'm sure in his solo albums, maybe there's the odd bit. But generally speaking, he is not, he's a guitarist.
So should we take it that this musical undertaking of his for this project kind of, for want of a better phrase, got it out of his system? it exhausted the interest for him a little bit? Like, you know, in that sense, because I think we associate George Harrison's sitar a lot throughout the Beatles' career. It's interesting to think that he released this album, which is predominantly only sitar, and then didn't pick it up much more after that. That's quite interesting.
I think in terms of playing the sitar himself, and by the way, I don't think it, maybe he plays a little bit of sitar on this, but it, broadly speaking, most of it is played by Indian musicians.
Yeah.
In terms of playing the sitar himself, I think he kind of got to the state, because to master it in the way that Ravi Shankar mastered it, you are looking at years and years of proper practice, you know, in a way that, you know, you can't really sit down on a sitar and just sort of, you know, bang out a riff, you know.
Smoke on water.
Right, exactly.
I can imagine.
Yeah. The significant thing all this had really kicked off for him was his sort of lifelong quest for spiritual enlightenment, you know, which was deeply held and sincere, and he had for the rest of his life, and into his death and reincarnation, if Olivia Harrison's account is to be believed.
It's quite.
Wait, sorry, that makes it sound like I'm skeptical about it.
Yes,
We should probably save this for when we do the George Harrison documentary that claim is made in. But it is a fascinating claim.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes, it was a sincere spiritual quest that he had for his entire life.
Yeah.
And I think he sort of, that was the thing that he took from it, you know. So it would be, I think there's lots and lots of 60s musicians who just sort of like flirted with things like sitar because it sounded cool. George properly took in Indian spiritualism into his heart and lived by it. Well, I mean, he took a lot of cocaine and had a lot of affairs, but other than
took
that he
into his heart as well.
yeah.
Going back to the sitar psychedelia thing, is that interesting? Do we think, or is it of your opinion, that George Harrison is directly responsible for that connection between the psychedelic period and sitar music? Like, would that exist without him, do you think?
No, I don't think it would. I think the Beatles, and George in particular, are responsible for an awful lot of change that they brought to the West. Now, maybe things like this would have happened anyway, and I think we sort of discussed this a bit in the yesterday episode. This idea that things like, you know, maybe yoga wouldn't be quite so widespread in the West without the Beatles, and George in particular, introducing them. The idea of thinking of oneself as spiritual as opposed to religious is it's much easier thing to express these days. It's a much easier thing for other people to take on board and take seriously. You might be thought of as a bit of a hippie for saying it, you know, but I mean, it's not as ludicrous as it was. It would have been in sort of, you know, 1965 when he first found a sitar on the set of Help. The idea of, you know, I mean, Help is all about, there is gentle mockery of sort of Eastern spiritual practices in there. Some of it not so gentle even. And the reason you can make that joke is it was just thought of as weird and outlandish, you know, and even a bit silly maybe, you know. But no, I mean, these things he and the Beatles absolutely helped to bring into the mainstream, I think.
This is kind of, I don't want to just repeat the point that you've already made, but for fear of that being sort of brushed aside, it is actually quite mind-boggling to me that any time there's any kind of like trippy, surreal sequence in any film, not completely separate from the Beatles, sitar music plays, right? That is just part and parcel of that.
Yeah.
That's just something that I hadn't really considered before, but I think, I think you're probably right in that. I think it probably is down to George Harrison's influence and that interest coming along at the same time as that psychedelic period of the Beatles coming to the fore. Coming back to Wonderwall, before we venture too far down the spiritual plane.
Yeah.
Last question on this before we talk about the film sort of more generally, but do we think that the music that George has produced for this film has kind of gone largely underappreciated? Because I don't feel like it's, you know, the fact that it is, the fact that it holds a claim to being the first solo album by a Beatle, it never gets talked about in the same way that his first actual solo album is post-Beatles split, All Things Must Pass. And obviously, you know, with the other Beatles. In fact, actually, a better comparison might be Two Virgins.
Yeah.
Because that still gets mentioned a lot as part of the Beatles story.
Yes.
Wonderwall just doesn't
at all. And the same with electronic sound that George made in 69 as well, right. Which is just him and a Moog synthesizer. Yeah, it doesn't get talked about all that much.
Do you really think that's just because it's convenient to not include it in a Beatles story that predominantly focuses on McCartney and Lennon?
No, I think it is more because the music itself that is being made is, you know, you
less commercial.
You can't hum it, you know. You know what I mean?
Fair enough.
Like, although, you know, there are some melodies that Wonderwall is arguably a bit of an exception. Wonderwall music, the album, is arguably a bit of an exception to that. I mean, so that there are certainly bits that you can hum, you know, and bits that do kind of stick in the mind.
Mm.
So because this is the interesting thing about the Beatles is that every time they try and do something avant-garde, they do it very successfully. But they just can't help but put melodies in it because it's just how they are. Melodies just pour out of them. So, yeah, there are melodies in... So the guitar riff that is sort of very identifiably Eric Clapton playing is very memorable.
That's a real standout moment in the soundtrack because it's not like the rest of the music that's been played up until that point.
Right, yeah, exactly. And there's one called Party Seekum as well, which is quite memorable. There's one called Cowboy Music, which is very sort of,
right.
You know, that kind of cowboy thing. You know, and like, so he is like within this, I suppose this is the thing where it's like, if someone says to you, as the director apparently did to George, say, just do what you want. Because George had said, well, I don't really know how to do a film score. And the director said, just do whatever you want, you know. And so I think that certainly leads it to be a bit disjointed in terms of how the music is used in the film, whereabouts it appears. But he could be forgiven for just being sort of noodling and very, very self-indulgent, you know. But actually, you know, there are melodies in it. He's obviously expressing a kind of sincere passion for Indian music at the time, you know, and I think that comes through.
I mean, he could equally just be excused for just writing 90 minutes of 12-bar blues, right? Just doing that, because the whole conceit in the film is just the neighbours are playing loud music. Like, it's entirely on him to determine what kind of music that is.
Well, that's true, isn't it? Yeah. Well, that's a good point, actually, because, so one of the things about the film is there are quite long periods where there's no dialogue.
Mm.
And so the music has to do some of the heavy lifting. But you're right that, well, that could have been any kind of music. But also what's happening is that the main character, Oscar Collins, is a slightly straight-laced, although perhaps with some eccentricities, scientist who lives on his own, who discovers a hole in his wall, looks through it and sees that his neighbours are sort of the beautiful people, young Londoners who are part of the what would you even call that scene? I was about to say the psychedelic scene, but that's not even a thing.
At one point, the boyfriend calls it out, saying that his girlfriend is part of the modelling scene.
Okay.
So like modelling scene, fashion industry, you know, that's sort of
right.
It's specifically that.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. But what he sees when he spies on them through the holes in his wall is a lot of, not even necessarily drug taking, but the sort of parties at which you imagine drug taking is going on. Mm. They're all tuning in, turning on, and dropping out. So I suppose in George's mind, writing a score for this, he must be thinking, well, I mean, you know, he's been part of this scene himself for so long.
Yeah, that's true.
To the extent that actually by 1968, he's almost sort of, I think by this point, he's stopped taking LSD. He's had that experience where he went to California and found, as he says in the anthology, loads of horrible spotty kids on drugs.
Yeah.
And I think he's sort of gone off it, you know. So by this point, he's almost sort of writing a score for a film about a scene that he's more or less rejected, you know.
Mm.
I suppose he's trying to write sort of general weirdness as opposed to noise that is disturbing and loud necessarily.
But do you think, because you mentioned before that this is this would have become shortly after Rishikesh.
Yeah.
And do you think there's anything in him looking at a film like this, where the idea is that his neighbours are being loud, they're having parties and taking drugs, and his most recent experience of that kind of thing for him is that it's accompanied by sitar music.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, yeah, is it literally, yeah, like, you know, from experience, like, you know, the last time we were all hanging out and taking drugs and you know, having essentially sort of like party atmosphere.
Yeah.
There was that kind of music played.
Well, I think it's more probably that he has helped to establish and define this scene more than pretty much anyone else. I mean, he's established this by putting "Within You, Without You" on Sergeant Pepper. You know, so this is what, even at this point, I guess people are thinking of Sergeant Pepper as like the sort of defining statement on the sort of flower power era, if you like. And his one song on it is a sort of an Indian classical mixed with English classical. You know,
and there are points in the soundtrack for this film where I swear it feels like it's going to go into "Within Without You." Like, there are moments where, and I'm sure that it's just because of my lack of, you know, understanding of the, no doubt, centuries of back catalogue of sitar music that I'm just unfamiliar with. But for me, it's, I hear some sitar music, it's like, I swear that's going to go into the other piece of sitar music that I know, "Within Without You." But there are specific times where it feels like there is like a syncopated rhythm that is being played at the same time as a sitar melody over the top. Mm. And it's like, this feels to me like it's a very similar segue into what that song becomes on the album.
Yeah.
I guess what's quite interesting to me is the idea that George was, in the first place, first approached to write the music for this film.
Yeah.
In theory, in order to accept that offer, he would have had to have an understanding of the film and what it was trying to say and do, and then say, yes, I want to be a part of this. First of all, what do you think of the film, I guess, and what's it trying to say? And I guess I'm trying to work out how it might align to the Beatles at that point in their career, and why they might be interested, why George in particular obviously might be interested in being a part of that as a creative project when it's so surreal.
Yeah, so I think surrealism is something that they're all sort of interested in to an extent. Mm-hmm. You know, so one of the sort of main themes in the film is it's sort of exploring this idea, as Magic Christian does as well, straight-laced British society being disrupted by the beautiful people, you know, young people who reject social norms and whatnot. So that's kind of what is that sort of thing is taking place within Oscar's flat, you know, this whole thing where, and it's not just that he is, this thing is kind of starting to obsess him. He has a sort of prurient interest in it. So, you know, I mean, this idea of sort of being horrified by what the young people are getting up to, but also that you are secretly titillated by it, you know.
Yeah.
In the same way as the British tabloid press do to this day, it will sort of affect to be outraged by sort of women's behaviour while also putting a picture of them in a bikini next to it to illustrate the picture.
I don't even know whether he seems in the film, though, to be particularly... pretend to be particularly outraged by it. He just, you know, it's not a... at no point, I think, does he as a character feel like he is judging his neighbours at all. He's just... It translates to me as like a longing for that. But I completely agree with you in that instance. It's clearly about this sort of British straight-lacedness, like you say, versus the free-spirited... you know, young hippie scene. But I really kind of enjoyed that metaphor in this film.
Mm.
And it's very, very, like, it's really in your face. This is a film that wears its metaphor on its sleeve a lot.
Right,
and it's, you know, there's a lot of heavy-handed symbolism in the film, but it's kind of, I kind of enjoy that about the movie because that's kind of how I like my symbolism. I like it where it's very obvious and I can see it. I can know what it's trying to say and what it's trying to tell me, but I can still sort of, you know, scratch my chin and nod my head and be like, oh yes, I understood that reference, you know. Like, you know, it makes me feel clever for watching the film and being like, oh, I understand what you're trying to do there, you know.
Yeah. Good old fashioned British symbolism.
Yes, exactly.
You know, before,
but like stuff like, you know, because but I do think it works really well. I think there's a lot of, you know, the overall idea of this, the Wonderwall in itself being this object through which Oscar enjoys this sort of voyeuristic experience, yeah, of this other part of life that he ultimately fantasizes about. But also this idea that as he becomes more obsessed with his neighbor, he sort of chips away for new holes in that wall, and that ends up almost, you know, in turn chipping away at his own persona, and he becomes a little bit more eccentric and a little bit more sort of further removed from his sort of intellectual pursuits. But then also other things like the fantasy sequences. I loved all of those. I loved him fighting Superman with a big pen.
Yeah.
I loved him being stabbed with a giant lipstick. Yeah. Like, you know, all these things are sort of, there's this, I don't know, they kind of ultimately play into this idea of like male inadequacy, even sexual inadequacy, you know, versus this, the object of his affection, the neighbor, and her current studly boyfriend. Mm. You know, I think you can, on a surface level, think of this film much like Magic Christian, where there's a lot of silly slapstick stuff happening. But yeah, I do think there's a lot of work happening under the surface, which Magic Christian did not have at all.
Yeah, I think it's sort of, it's getting to something that's like quite key in the British psyche, I suppose. This idea, who was it who said, like, an Englishman will consider his life a success if he can get through it without ever being publicly embarrassed. but yeah, I think there's something in that where this is sort of what it's saying, this thing about being British, where it's politeness and there's a straight lacedness and just not wanting to sort of upset the apple cart, I suppose. And actually, because this could be read as a story about a guy who is, you know, a peeping Tom, you know, it's but actually his interest in her is not particularly sexual. There is a scene in which she and her boyfriend are having sex, and like Oscar's reaction to it is that, like, there's a little montage where he's making like more and more holes as quickly as he can in order to look through from lots of different angles. That's kind of played comically, and so I'm not saying he has no sexual interest in her, but moreover, there is, as you say, a longing for a life that's a life that he doesn't have, and it's not even just about loneliness necessarily. It's about sort of British repression, like you know, this is the life I could have if only I was prepared to let myself go in some way, you know. And I suppose that's one of the things about why this period of British cultural life was so revolutionary, is that you had all these people who were willing to break these norms that had been established so long ago and maintained, you know, throughout British society for decades, for generations, you know. And there's a thing about being British that is, you know, not being able to lose one's inhibitions necessarily, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of what it's trying to get at.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah.
think the thing that I was surprised by it was that the film actually handles that in a very mature way. Doesn't seem like it on the surface, but actually there's a lot of, you know, there's things about what it means, you know, to be able to be at the center of that kind of cultural movement in order to make a film like this, and then decide to tell it from the point of view of an older man who then is made to feel insecure as a result of that movement happening, like on his doorstep. I think that's quite a mature take on that.
Yeah.
What it means for how he feels about himself, his self-identity, and I think all of those things are absolutely present in that movie.
Yeah.
And then right through to, you know, the actual culmination of the story is a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
It can almost get lost a little bit in the sort of overt surreal visuals of the film and the sort of the trippy nature of it. But ultimately, this is about him spying on his neighbour and then realising that she's actually not happy at the centre of that whole scene.
Yeah.
To the extent that she tries to take her own life.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, that's quite a obviously a very serious take on that sort of cultural movement.
Yeah.
As explored in this film. I was quite surprised by that. And I think I, you know, approaching this film, having not seen it before, I've not really known what to expect.
Yeah.
I think halfway through, you know, we name checked it a couple of times, but halfway through I was thinking, oh, this is just like Magic Christian. This is how I sort of see this film behaving. But it wasn't until further on in the movie I realised it was doing something much more sophisticated.
Yeah, I think so. Because I think also, yeah, I think there's something to be said about women's role and how they fit into the whole revolution that was going on in the 1960s, because there's a sexual revolution going on as well. People are becoming much more laissez-faire about sex. There are birth control pills now. You know, this is quite a new thing. There's also the fact that, you know, you think about songs like "For No One." There's the kind of, and "Babies in Black" as well. There's a sort of hint at a darkness in a free-spirited woman. You know what I mean?
Like that she
may, and I suppose, you know, Eleanor Rigby as well, I suppose, you know, the character is, you know, wearing a face that she keeps in a jar by the door, that, you know, and who is it for? There's this whole idea of showing a certain face to the world, but perhaps there's a sadness behind it. And, you know, that's Wonderwall is kind of exploring that too with the character of Penny Lane, you know, and this is Jane Birkin playing her as well, by the way, you know. So this is Jane Birkin, who next year would team up with Serge Gainsbourg to record, is it called Je T'aime, Moi Non Plus? You know? And so, you know, this is absolutely iconic in terms of the sexual revolution that was going on. That was, you know, that that song was banned all over the place, you know, for being too sexy. You know,
like me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, all Right Said Fred, for example. You know. she really was the Right Said Fred of her time. Day.
This film being made now, the temptation would be to make Oscar Collins's character more sinister.
Yes.
You know, because that is kind of how these kind of more voyeuristic films play out now. They are thrillers, and it's more about you never know who's watching you.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that there's no sort of hint of malice that comes out in this film. It's just one of sort of longing and anxiety, I guess.
Yeah. But, you know, you think about how a similar thing plays out in a film like American Beauty, where Kevin Spacey is obsessed with his daughter's friend. But a lot of... It's much more about the sort of suffocation of the self, in a way, the sort of, you know, the American middle class self, you know, and like trying to keep up appearances of the, you know, the privet hedge and all the rest of it, you know. Whereas this seems to be less, in a funny way, they're not particularly using it to say anything about Oscar's character himself. They're using Oscar's character to say something about society instead, you know.
Talking of which, we should, I guess, try to understand what the movie is trying to say about that based on how it decides to end its film. So I think if we're looking at the film being reflective of society at the time, I think it's interesting that the film goes down this road of suicide. You could say that all the roads that led us there were winding. that was really not intentional. Sorry. I just constantly got the lyrics playing back.
Yeah, I'm going to have to think of one before the end of the episode.
just to round things off.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, you know, it goes down this road of exploring this, the idea that Penny Lane is unhappy to the extent that she wants to take her own life.
Yeah.
But also then that the film's ending is open to interpretation. And I think it's important that the film doesn't make a conclusion there, because you could read the ending that the film presents, which is one that Oscar actually saved her life. His colleagues are reading the story in the newspaper about how he saved her life, and they all applaud him as he comes back into the lab.
Yeah,
I think it's quite easy to suggest that that is just another one of his fantasy sequences.
Yeah,
in that moment.
Yeah.
So therefore, like, you know, I guess the film maybe is ultimately making some kind of statement on, you know, the fantasy being better than the reality. Because that's ultimately what Penny discovers as trying to be part of the model scene and actually finding herself unhappy as a result of it.
Yeah, quite possibly. I think there is. So I mean, one of the things about the ending is the fact that she makes a suicide attempt is a proper narrative beat. You know? That is a bid to take the story somewhere, which up until this point. It hasn't done an awful lot with. A lot of, as we said when we were talking about Magic Christian, a lot of the sort of psychedelic cinema of this period seems to be characterized by a sort of discarding of narrative, and in its place, a lot of sort of seemingly unconnected scenes. Unconnected, but where the story is not necessarily being moved on at all times. It's quite happy to be sort of meditative and to let you just sit and think, you know, for quite a while, you know. The suicide attempt is a story, you know, yeah. And it works in that way, you know.
It's also extremely, I thought, very clever when Oscar then finds himself in a situation where he is spying on someone trying to resuscitate Penny, and he's giving mouth to mouth in a way that mimics how he was watching the earlier sex scene.
Yeah.
It's a much sort of darker revisit of that earlier scene.
Yeah.
That again, I think just speaks of the film's surprising sophistication. I think to be able to make those kind of callbacks and to have like a darker lens, darker filter on that, given the events, I think is quite surprisingly smart thing that the film does.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, for him, I suppose he's in a position where he could be sort of facing ruin by it coming out that he's been obsessing over his young neighbour. It's not the sort of thing a gentleman in his position does, of course, you know. Remind me, how does it work? Like, he has gone into her flat.
Mm-hmm.
Dressed as a circus ringmaster for some reason, which is fine. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that you just don't question in a movie like this.
Fine, yeah. And so while there, she makes a suicide attempt. He sort of tries to revive her, but then doesn't he sort of alert someone else to call an ambulance in some way?
Yeah.
But I forget, does he do it in such a way whereby it can't be identified that he was in her flat or something like that.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So he's not in her flat at the time when someone comes along to actually save her life. He's still watching from the other side.
Yeah, okay, that's it, yeah. I suppose, you know, because that's almost his only, his only interaction with reality, in, you know, when he actually crosses the wall, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, on the other side of the wall, you know, who's to say what's real and what's not, you know,
on which side of
the wall. I suppose it's kind of, you know, what it's driving at.
I don't know. I will say again, I felt like all of this stuff, like there's exactly what you just said, like this idea of there being a wall between reality and fantasy, between British intellectualism and free-spirited love movement, like And it being a literal wall.
Yeah.
And like, even to the extent that when he decides to really go like whole hog with this pursuit of spying on his neighbor, and in order to do that, he like actively cuts out a canvas painting. Like, you're stripping back like this sort of art, art facade that's hanging on the wall to be able to get through to the bare bones brickwork behind it in order to spy. I think it's all about stuff where he's actually having to sort of cut through those kind of boundaries and barriers and stuff. And I realise this is like metaphor 101. But again, it just satisfies that brain itch that I have when I'm watching something like that. It's like, I get all of this, and I'm quite happy that I get all of this. And it doesn't have to be subtle. Right. I'm just pleased that I get it. We talked a bit about George Harrison and his musical contribution. I think it was interesting that in addition to that, the neighbour was called Penny Lane.
Mm.
That feels like a unnecessary connection to make to the Beatles.
Yeah.
Like, George Harrison's enough. You don't, you know,
there
isn't any other sort of overt connection to the Beatles. So it felt like an odd choice, I thought, for me.
Yeah. One of the strange things about it, or something that I picked up on, was there's a character called Young Man who's the guy who comes over to Oscar's flat to sort of borrow ice and things like that.
Oh, yeah,
he's the boyfriend, basically. Yeah, yeah. And I looked him up because his voice was dubbed, it seemed to me.
I thought so as well, yes. With a Liverpudlian accent.
Right, yeah. And he sounded an awful lot like Peter Serafinowicz, weirdly, like... That kind of it's quite gentle Liverpool accent. I looked him up, and the guy is called Ian Quarrier, and he's Canadian. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Maybe it's him, or maybe it's somebody else. But the voice is being dubbed, or at least a decision has been made here to have the guy talk in a slight to sound a bit like a Beatle.
Yes, right?
It's basically what's happening there. And I thought, why has that choice been made? Is that because we think the audience would sort of generally associate a Scouse accent with hippies, or with the sort of swinging, ironically swinging London scene? Just that maybe it's an easy shorthand for an audience. Say, yes, this is hippies all sound like the Beatles, don't they?
But also, or to be more cynical about it, is it just trying to capitalize on the George Harrison connection? Like, if at a point when you know you've got George writing music for the film and you're going to overdub the actor, I wonder if that decision is made after that sort of deal is struck and you're then gearing the film more towards a fan base or an audience that have that kind of interest.
Quite possibly, yeah.
I think another thing that I discovered upon researching the film after watching it was that there is a Dutch design collective called The Fool, who did a lot of the art design for the movie. But do you know what their connections to the Beatles are?
Yes. So they had the shop down in Notting Hill, I think it was. And so they did a lot of artwork, including painting John's psychedelic Rolls Royce, painting Paul's piano that he uses for Magical Mystery Tour to this day. They painted maybe a mural on George's wall at his house in Kinfauns, I want to say, something like that.
I heard that they also painted his Mini Cooper.
Oh, yes.
So maybe that's right.
And maybe his, the Fender Stratocaster in the sort of pink psychedelic colours.
Yeah, he did that himself.
Did he?
Yeah. Okay. I'm sure I've read things about how he that one night just basically just stripped his guitar down and painted that himself.
Wow.
And turned up the next day and was like, this is how my guitar looks now. Deal with it, yeah.
Wow, okay. Wow, brilliant.
But yeah, so interesting. No Beatles connection there for you. Other than that, there are a lot of apples in the film.
Yes.
I don't know if that's, again, that's a pointed thing.
Yeah.
And again, you could point to obvious symbolism, like, the apple being a symbol of knowledge, original sin as well, and temptation.
Yeah.
But also just Apple Records.
Yeah. But then at the point it was being filmed, would they have known that was Apple a thing? Would they have known about it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I think this, because in terms of what we're told about how George recorded the score, or wrote the score, is that he was given the film to watch and sort of had a stopwatch and sort of timed the bits where he was going to put music in. So this has been made, I don't know if it's already been completely made before George's involvement, but certainly that his music work is the last thing to happen, it seems.
Mm.
And I'm not sure of the timeline, but I think, I don't know, that the apple might be a genuine coincidence. But yeah. Because it is a properly green apple of the kind. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and it becomes red later on, actually. He starts eating a red apple later on when he's like to eat or not to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Also, we haven't mentioned it before, but I did think it was interesting that actually the budget for the music for the film was really, because it's a low budget film.
Mm.
So the budget for the film, I think, for the music of the film was something like £600.
Okay.
But George Harrison stumped up 15,000 of his own money to be able to actually do the, to complete the project in the way that he wanted to, and, you know, hire out. It was actually at Abbey Road Studios, and hire the musicians he wanted and stuff, which is brilliant, because, you know, you can imagine like a director coming to him and saying, I want you to write music for the film, do whatever you like and I put it in.
Mm.
And then for George to be like, fine, I will invest almost as much money as the film's entire budget to make that happen for you. As a director, you've hit a goldmine there. Right?
But he must have been passionate about it, and he must have cared about it creatively. Like, it's sort of, it's interesting to think about in Get Back, where they're having that conversation, you know, and George is saying, well, you know, I've got all these songs, I could go and do a solo album.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they seem to be... almost come into this accord of like, you know, we can all go off and do our own thing and then get back together and be Beatles every now and again. But, you know, George is not the only one, because the rest have done it as well by this point. But George has kind of already done this. He's kind of already set this template, because he's recorded Wonderwall music and he's recorded electronic sound and, you know, and sort of come back and been a Beatle again, you know. And so it's nice that he can sort of go off and be genuinely passionate about something, you know.
And I'm sure that a big, you know, I kind of knew the answer to my own question when I raised it earlier about how does this sit alongside the view of George a year later in the Let It Be sessions, being more unsure of himself as a songwriter and leaning on the other band members to ask for their advice and how to complete songs, and not necessarily being too forthcoming or too pushy with his own music and stuff. He just seems a bit more sort of more insecure about that. And I think the answer is because he's in the band with those band members.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it is a completely separate project. He can, you know, and it's a dream project for him, really. If he's being told, do whatever you like and I'll use it no matter what.
Yeah.
Like, that's free restraint. There's no, you know, this idea of him being uncertain about how to write a film score for another project might have actually put pay to it early on, but actually being given that artistic freedom to do whatever you want would have sort of played exactly into what he needed, I think, at that time to be able to do this.
I think also that it's instrumental too, so he's not sort of writing songs
in
the same way. So I suppose that certainly when if he's writing a song and he's in the same room as John or Paul, it kind of makes sense to say, hey, what do you reckon to this or whatever? Whereas I'm sure he felt comfortable enough with sort of writing instrumental stuff, particularly Indian stuff, that was kind of his thing, you know, and that he could just go off and do that and didn't particularly feel like he needed, you know, anyone else's guidance on it.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, like, I know how we've talked about it being sort of a project where he was able to just sort of noodle a bit. But I'm sure, like you say, it would have been a real passion project for him. And it was, you know, it did serious business at the time. It's I say business, not in terms of box office, but it was a success at Cannes. And it's only subsequently that the film failed to pick up a distribution deal, so it's got lost, and there hasn't really been a proper full release of the film.
Yeah.
But at the time, I think it was, you know, it would have been seen as a serious endeavour. So like him noodling on the film, which he absolutely does, I think is still an artistic choice. rather than one where he feels like he can do something a bit half-hearted, which that might suggest. So yeah, I think I guess my main takeaway from the film is that I was pleasantly surprised by how mature it was, given sort of the sensibilities it wears on its sleeve a little bit. Yeah. But yeah, I was quite impressed with actually the thought and consideration that had gone into exploring relatively sophisticated themes in the film. And actually, as a result of that, really loved it. Wasn't expecting to, but yeah. Really, really enjoyed watching it. In preparation for this, I watched it a second time as well, and just really enjoyed the heck out of it.
Yeah,
really good. What are your thoughts on the film? Did you gel with it as much as I did?
Not as much as you did, but I did enjoy it. Yeah, and I think the fact that it has something to say. And it is occasionally a bit of a blunt instrument in that metaphor, as you say. You know, unlike you, I prefer a subtler metaphor, you know, a continental metaphor. You know. I think it is nuanced, but it occasionally is a bit of a blunt instrument in what it's trying to express. But it is trying to say something, and overall it succeeds in saying that thing, in the same way that, you know, when we were talking about the supposed anti-capitalist message of The Magic Christian, it doesn't you can see that it is trying to do that, but it is not succeeding.
It loses its way quickly, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And Wonderwall, and after all, Wonderwall basically achieves what it sets out to achieve.
I'm going to wrap things up there.
Okay.
Yeah. I think our listeners hopefully would have approached this episode expecting at least a few Oasis puns on here. I'm sure they've heard it all before, but it never really had a doubt. Hopefully you have enjoyed this episode. If you have, please do write us a review or get in touch with us on the social media platforms. You can reach us at Beatles Films Pod on all of those usual viral spaces. And otherwise, we'll be back again next week with another episode. So hopefully you listen then, and we'll see you then. Thanks and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.